The Brazen Android by William Douglas O'Connor. Part 4. The figure on the threshold was the Paduan. A vague dread rising to a terror, inspired by his peculiar appearance, succeeded the moments of fright which his unannounced entrance gave the two friars. He was a man whose age it would have been impossible to determine. So strange a mixture of haughty youth and gray maturity was there in his general presence. In person, he was tall and shapely, with so much majesty of port that even the majestic Bacon looked inferior in contrast. And yet, mysteriously confused with his august demeanor, was a certain flickering air as of ghastly decrepitude, which made the whole seem incongruous and appalling. All that inspires homage, even unto worship, was in his bearing. But in it was also an indefinable element startle and repel homage in the very act of prostration. He wore a long robe of black silk edged with sable, and drooping in ample folds below the knee. And what was noticeable, while his legs, closely sheathed in high travel-worn boots of brown cordovan, were strong and beautifully formed, they terminated in feet graceful indeed in their narrow length and suppleness, but so strangely lean, and their bones and cordy tendons so apparent through the thin leather coverings, that what with this and with the down-curving pointed toes of the boots themselves, they suggested a morbid fancy of an ill-concealed hybrid of foot and claw. In his hand he held a black traveling cap of a curious pattern, from which depended a trailing sable plume fastened by a single lurid jewel, a fire opal, evidently of great purity and value. The whole character of his countenance was that of a mournful and supramortal, but evil beauty. His forehead, surmounted by a splendid chevelure of curling coal-black hair which fell to his shoulders, was not only large, it was enormous. Strangely, even fearfully developed in the region of ideality, so much so that the protuberances of the marble temples seemed swelling into horns, while the whole front of the brow was only less powerfully prominent, it gave an expression of overpowering intellectuality to the face itself, which was terrible and painful to behold. A secret and supreme despair rested upon the colorless face like a shadow. A still, sluggish light flamed in the large, dark, mesmeric eyes, overarched by their black brows. The nose was aquiline, beautiful and haughty. The lips were wreathed with a superb and desolating scorn. The face was beardless, and the bold outline of the chin was the expression of an inexorable will. The whole presence of the man filled the mind with that sensation felt only after the passage of some unearthly dream. Such was the profound and learned Dr. Malatesti. Bacon was the first to recover his composure. "Welcome, my illustrious Dr. Malatesti," said he. "Welcome once more to England." "Great thanks for your courtesy, my marvelous doctor," replied the Paduan, bowing so low that his obeisance savored of grave mockery. "Great thanks to you both, my learned frères. I accost ye both, good celibates." He strode forward 2 steps from the threshold into the gloomy light of the room as he ceased speaking, and the door closed with a fierce crash behind him. The friar stood startled and terrified. Bacon himself, with his disposition to refer occurrences to natural causes, could not but feel the nervous perturbation which will possess the coolest mind when such occurrences assume the aspect of the supernatural. The supposition, however, that the Paduan had deftly shut the door with his foot upon entering, instantly succeeded the fantastic impression that it had been closed by its own agency. though this in turn was dissipated in a vague sense of dread, as following his thought, his eye rested upon the taloned feet of Malatesti, and received the morbid suggestion their strange shape conveyed. At the same moment, a long moan of wind sounded eerily through the grisly gloom, followed by a sullen roll of thunder dying away in sluggish reverberations, and the rushing of rain. The friar looked up with a beating heart, conscious only for an instant of the dark majesty of the motionless figure before him, conscious the next instant that his eyes, burning with a still naphthalene flame, were fixed upon Bungie, whose face was yellow with dismay. At once Bacon, with a mingled feeling of shame that he had suffered himself to be thus affected, and a secret anger at the Paduan's behavior, controlled himself into calm. "Good Dr. Malatesti," he said with an assumption of phlegm, "this is my co-laborer, Thomas Bungie."
"I know him well," was the shrill reply. "He is as big as a cask."
The visitor's face was void of all expression as he made this strange remark, but whether in the remark itself or in the tone in which it was offered, there was involved a contempt so tremendous that it wrought revulsion in the sturdy breast of Bungie, so that his dismay was suddenly overflowed with hearty rage. Nevertheless, he held himself in check, and with an air of indifference, lounged down upon the settle.
"It is the effect of study," he said complacently, lazily eyeing the Paduan while he nonchalantly played with his rosary. "Study bloats a man hugely. At least it maketh me big, while it causeth Frere Roger to wax meagre."
"You came upon us without warning, Dr. Malatesti," said Bacon, interrupting the burly friar in the exposure he was making of himself. "How happened it that you gained admittance? For I heard not your challenge at the portal."
"Truly," replied the Paduan, "I was spared the pains of knocking by your shapely servitor, who opened the door as I set foot upon the steps, and ran away on beholding me."
"Ah, the brute!"
broke in Friar Bungie, his suppressed rage at the Paduan readily transferred into open manifestations against Cuthbert.
"The misshapen varlet! Thus, Roger, doth he maltreat our visitors! By Mary, but I will clapperclaw him!"
"Tush, tush," said Bacon impatiently. "Cuthbert is commonly faithful and decorous, and needs patience and kind treatment in his oddities, rather than the discipline of your rude fist. Good Dr. Malatesti, I pray you be seated. Are you newly from Italy?" The Paduan, with the mien of some dark emperor, seated himself in Bacon's chair, and drawing his long rapier from its sheath under his robe, laid it, as if for convenience, on the oaken table.
"I am but just landed at St. Botolph's Wharf," he said, "and am newly from Italy."
"Where lodge you during your sojourn with us?" asked Bacon.
"In the air," was the strange answer.
A feeling that the Paduan was indeed mad flitted through the mind of the friar, but controlling his uneasiness, he affected to perceive nothing singular in his reply.
"You will be pleased to know, good friars," continued the Italian, "you who are so given to dabbling in public matters, that your Antichrist, my beloved Pope Innocent, lies at the point of death. You start. Nay, even popes must die, though fortunately the apostolic succession is secure. Fortunately, I say, for, whatever you may think, such pontiffs are necessary as blocks to the fast and far-going wheels of your de Montforts and Grosseteste, who would fain roll the world on a track which would ill suit my political philosophy."
"Nay, good doctor," said Bacon, hastily interposing to prevent the explosion of English wrath which suddenly fermented in the sturdy heart of Bungy, and flushed his large face at the taunting speech of the visitor.
Let us not bandy politics. Let us rather hold discourse on matters of science, in which you are a rare adept.
My good Frere Bungy is, after the matter of the 13th century, a patriot, pursued the Paduan with a strange laugh, evidently paying no attention to Bacon.
Yea, but 'tis my doctrine that churchmen should not meddle in matters of state. There must be neither religion nor morals in politics.
Then were politics irreligious and immoral, said Bacon.
'Tis a doctrine worthy of the archfiend, roared Bungy.
Then 'tis a worthy doctrine, replied the Paduan, with a placid gravity of face, strangely at variance with the devilish sneer of his voice.
Bacon warned Bungy with a look to remain silent. There was an uneasy dread in his heart at the aspect and manner of the Doctor Malatesti, which was heightened by the wild quality of his voice. The tones were grave, yet intensely shrill. Their shrillness was in itself startling and unearthly, and bore, moreover, a fearful incongruity with the still mesmeric light of his eyes, the calmness of his enormous brow, the solemn, scornful power and mournful beauty of his whole countenance. The laugh, too, with which he had commenced a former remark was singularly unhuman. While it resembled in sound a piercing peal of mirth, there was yet no accompanying movement of the muscles of his face to denote any degree of humor. The voice alone had laughed. The face was cold and immobile as marble.
"To think," resumed the Italian, "to think of such a fat frockly as you, Bacon, reforming what you call the abuses of the realm. 'Tis marvelous. Reform? Can you reform yourself? Remake, if you can, what sire and mother and the life of man made you. Go to, I bid you despair. Preach roses and live nightshade. 'Tis the fashion and the fate of man."
"I know not what preaching roses and living nightshade may be," said Bungy angrily, "but I do know."
"Preach against gluttony and wine-bibbing, and practice both continually," interrupted the Paduan.
"By my dame," retorted the fat friar, "but this passes. Thou saucy doctor, know this, that happy is that friar who can get a taste at odd seasons of stockfish and ale. Meantime, bread of the coarsest and water of the well are the Franciscans' food and drink. Mine is scanty enow, by Saint Swithin."
"Oh, oh," said the Paduan, "hear him swear, and by that pig of a Saxon. Resolve me this, Frockling. What did you dine on today?"
"A wooden table," shouted the friar.
"Eh, truly, Frockling, and what was on the table?" demanded the other.
"Barley crusts and pure water," answered Bungy stoutly,
yet with a shade of meekness in his tone.
"Eh, truly," sneered Malatesti, "your cousin the vintner hath a fashion of garnishing his board with barley crusts and water. Yet own the dinner you made off the better part of a calvered salmon, the pullet sauced with butter and barberries, forcemeat balls and the marrow pudding. Rare eating, Friar Bungy."
Bungy's face resumed its former yellow tinge of dismay. His fellow friar, with a single glance at him, saw that the Paduan's account of the repast was the true one, and at this proof of what might be termed in our age clairvoyant power, and which was another evidence of those strange sorts of knowledge he had ascribed to Malatesti, a cold fear crept through Bacon's soul that the latter might, by the same mysterious faculty, divine the secret of the android? Or was the Paduan no more than some mad charlatan, aiming to confound them with the knowledge he might possibly have gathered at the vintner's door or window?
"Rare eating, Frere Bungi," Malatestia continued. "And what of the drinking? What of the 9-hooped pot of mead you guzzled, and the spiced wine? Oh, see now!" And with one circular motion of his arm, the rapier swept up in his grasp from the table and down upon the huge breast of the corpulent Frere. The flask was pierced, and Bungi's frock suddenly showed a widening moisture.
"It is my blood!" he roared, starting to his feet.
Singularly enough, his first thought, no less than the alarmed Bacon's, was that he had received a wound.
"Yes," said the Paduan, whose rapier had already returned to the table. "Your blood. See it. Smell it."
In fact, the wine at that moment was plashing on the floor, and its spicy fumes were diffused upon the air of the chamber.
"I am he that degrades," said Malatesti in his awful voice, with his still eyes fixed upon the pallid visage of Bacon.
Bungi, shuddering through all his bulk, his healthy face grown flabby and livid, and his lips white in his gray beard, tremblingly drew the flask from his bosom, and turning it so that the wine ceased to flow from the puncture, helplessly sat down, gazing at it with a hoarse groan.
"It is wine I got for a poor widow," he snuffled presently, with a forlorn effort to maintain his self-respect.
"Hear him lie," said the Paduan, with an intonation of withering scorn.
Bacon remained silent.
"I am the apostle of despair," pursued Malatesti,
his eyes still fixed upon Bacon's countenance.
"I strip away the mask and show the man. Labor, labor to build the perfect realm. But the realm is made of men, and men are unchangeably bestial at the core. Wolf and snake, hog and harpy, are inextricably mixed in man, and virtue is nothing but a covering lie, itself the foulest vice of all. Despair, I say, despair. In this stripped friar, behold the type of your de Montforts, your Grosseteste, your saints and patriots as they are within. Look to their secret hearts, their hidden lives. There lies the brute half of the centaur man. Fair and white is the skin, but under the breastbone the hell pool rages. Oh, may it rage forever. Cheer, Bungi, cheer! The rest are like you.
Dr. Malatesti, said Bacon.
Hear me, interrupted the Paduan. Men are a base mixture, for flesh and soul agree not. But wise and great is the soul. Provide then to build the perfect realm by peopling the earth with souls. For what saith the schoolman? The soul is not man, he saith. Would it be man if joined to a body of brass? No, 'twould be then the pure soul. Ay, and then 'twould tell you how souls may people earth without these ruining bodies of flesh. It cannot tell you till it be shrined in some form which will permit it voice. It cannot tell you in the evil form of flesh, whose quality and motion suspend its spiritual knowledge. But in a form of brass it can tell you. Ay, you, a man, instructed by a soul, shrined in an android, can then accomplish the conditions which will render it possible for souls to descend to earth and achieve all things, undarkened in their knowledge by this form of clay. Never from man can you thus be instructed. The soul is metamorphosed in man. Soul and the elements of flesh conjoined make man. the base, the vile, the brutal, the foolish and unchangeable reprobate.
Dr. Malatesti, said Bacon sternly, be done with this, I pray you. For these wild and bitter thoughts I care not, but your conduct...
A crash of thunder broke his speech, and in the momentary confusion of his vision, the imperial figure of the Paduan seemed to loom up darkly before him in the sheeting flame which lit the room as from a gulf below. The next instant, amidst the receding reverberations and the rushing of the rain, he saw that the man had risen to his feet and was standing motionless in the gloom, the naphthalene light motionless in his eyes, his mournful features passionless and cold in the shadow which rested upon them, and the impression of ghastly decrepitude in his presence seeming stronger now than before, though, as before, unreferable to any trait of his form. The brave-hearted friar, though conscious that he was wrought upon by the weird illusions of the moment, felt their fullest power, and his soul quailed. Bungie, for his part, sat stupidly staring, utterly bewildered by what had passed.
"I am growing old," said the Paduan, in slow, wailing tones. "Long has been my term of haughty youth. Long, long, oh, long. And men have been as I wished them to be. Arts, laws, thoughts, religions, all have I withstood, nor have they shaken my empire. But the new spirit that rejects the dreams of the mind and tracks effects to their causes in nature, and will make its highest ideals effects by its knowledge of causes. It is born, and I am growing old."
At these strange words, Bacon shuddered vaguely, and a dark, mysterious, confused impression glimmered within him, as if not the Paduan, but another had spoken. An utter suspension of all sound save that of the storm succeeded.
"It is well," said Malatesti,
startling the silence with his piercing voice, and reviving the impression in Bacon's mind that the former speech had been uttered by another.
"You would say, Frere Bacon, that I have dealt unmannerly. Be it granted, as ye are both Christian men, good frères. Forgive me under the supreme law of charity. Say no more. How fares the android? See, I have taken such interest in your work that I have myself fashioned you the tongue."
Bacon recoiled aghast as the Paduan held toward him a model in gold of the human tongue, which he had taken from under his robe.
"The anatomia of this is perfect," pursued the unmoved Malatesti. "But it must be filled with a molten composition of mercury, brass dust, and sulphur, the proportions of which I will show you. It will then be ready for fusion with the head. Come, let us visit your laboratory."
Bungie started up abjectly at this imperative invitation, and moved to the door with the Paduan. Unable to interpose, unable even to think, Bacon followed with his brain in a whirl. Through a door on the opposite side of the passageway, the trio entered the sleeping room of the friars, an apartment similar in all respects to that they had left, save that its only furniture was a couple of chairs and two pallets spread upon the floor. A small iron effigy of St. Francis stood in a niche on the wall. Grasping this figure with both hands, Bungie drew it toward him. As if by magic, a portion of the oaken wainscot suddenly receded inward, revealing a dark vault from which floated a strong aromatic perfume. A moment,
and Bungie had lighted a torch within. Then, descending 3 stone steps, the others stood in the laboratory, and the gigantic friar, seizing an effigy similar to the other on the hither side of the wall, drew it toward him, and the wainscot closed behind them. The flaring torch, projecting from a socket in the wall, dimly lit up the cavernous gloom of the vault, and threw a ruddy, glimmering light on its grotesque mechanical and chemical furniture. Huddled and distorted black shadows, like a herd of monstrous phantoms, continually moved and flickered on the floor and walls, with the flapping and wavering of the flambeau. At one side of the apartment was the forge, a raised reredos, having somewhat of the shape of an altar, on which smoldered a dull fire of coals. And near it stood an anvil with hammers, smelting pots, crucibles, and other implements of the foundry strewn about. In the remoter part of the large space were rough tables covered with jars and flasks of stone and metal, glass retorts and alembics in which trembled divers-colored liquids, and the various utensils of chemistry, together with a multitude of objects too numerous for a brief inventory. Around rose the rough walls, built of blocks of stone, and begrimed with the smoke of all the fires that had burned on the reredos for perhaps a century. The form of the vault was an oblong square. Its windows were closely shuttered, and the high raftered ceiling, shrouded thick with shadow, would have been altogether undiscernible, save for a small circular opening in a corner of the roof, called in the language of the time, a louver, which served as an outlet for the smoke as also for ventilation, though it hardly admitted a ray from the clouded sky beyond. Presently, a stranger object than any lent the place a new interest. Pushed forward by Bungie from a shadowed recess into the center of the vault, and apparently rolling upon hidden casters, emerged a large square black pedestal on which stood a shrouded form. In a moment, Bungie had removed the covering and disclosed a large bust of brass, truncated above the elbows. The friar lit 2 cuneiform candles of yellow wax, which he placed upon the front corners of the pedestal on either side of the image. Their quiet radiance rested strangely on the burnished android, whose metal features seemed to survey the group with a steadfast and awful stare. In remembrance of Mala Testi, who had first suggested its formation, Bacon had molded the face into a counterpart of the Italian's terrible and demoniac beauty, and the flowing locks of metal which covered the head and fell to the shoulders were no less an imitation of the curling coal-black tresses of Mala Testi. But, though undesigned, there was in the expression of the android a still more startling resemblance, for the lips had been made partly open, and this, added to the stare of the blind, ball-less, awful eyes under the enormous brow, gave to the bright and terrible features an expression of living and terrific despair. It was a fearful intensification of the look which was secret and shadowed in the mournful face of the Paduan, but it was like a revelation of the true expression of his soul. He had seated himself at ease in an oaken chair before the image, and his eyes were fixed upon it. No sound murmured upon the somber silence of the vault, save the aerial and distant rushing of the river of rain. The quiet light of the tapers shed a weird radiance upon his vast and melancholy brow, and served to deepen his expression of solemn and mournful scorn. Silently watching him at some distance apart stood the 2 friars, but the flaring torch, flashing and falling on their shadowy features, threw no ray of its struggling light upon him. He seemed to sit alone, enveloped in a supernatural still splendor, rich and dim, stately and strange, from demon brow to taloned foot, in that great orb of wizard bloom. the android, a form of solid brightness, like an enchanted head of brassy flame, before him, and all endowed with the surrounding blackness. Only once, when a hissing jet spired from the resinous substance of the flambeau and penetrated the magic sphere of light in which he sat, Bacon saw a shadow play pass over his marble features, appearing to wreathe them into a dark and evil smile. And at that same moment, the smile appeared to be mimicked by the image. An instant after, and his features, like those of the brazen bust, wore their usual immobility. But it was hard for the pallid friar to withstand the distempered fancy that a demoniac signal had passed between the twain. A vague sense of horror and alarm rose struggling for a moment in his soul, and then sank down and was lost in spiritual gloom. The silence of the vault was at last broken by the shrill laugh of the Paduan, and as he rose to his feet, the flames of the torch and tapers licked downward, and the huddled lights and shadows of the place swayed and reeled in phantasmal commotion. Bacon glanced hurriedly at the louver, with a thought of the entering gust, and as his eyes rested again upon Malatesti, the lights and shadows were still.
"Ye have wrought well, my masters," cried the Italian. "Ye have wrought skillfully and well. Now, hark to my directions, for disobeyed, the spirit will not enter."
"The spirit, sweet Paduan?" faltered Bungie, visibly quailing.
"Spoke I not plainly?" said Malatesti, with withering hauteur. "Hear me. Within 3 days from the completion of your work, the spirit will enter, and the android will speak. I shall be here, and in my presence you shall own, Frere Bacon, as I told you a year ago, that this work is not delusion, but subject to the proof of experiment, which you so insist upon. But mark great, Freres, ye must not sleep, but sit and listen till ye hear its first command, which must be at once obeyed. Failing of this, the spirit will rend the metal and flee from it forever. Long and sore will be your vigil, but great its reward. Now, hearken to the nature of the composition ye must add to the android. But first take the image asunder, and let me view the interior."
Bungie shuddered, like one subdued to the will of the Paduan, made a step forward to obey, when Bacon stopped him by laying his hand on his arm. "Abide here," he said with solemn compassion, "and pray, Frere Thomas, pray fervently for this disordered soul." Bungie stared wildly at him, but Bacon, without pausing, advanced, pale and calm, with slow and steady steps, till he stood in front of the Paduan.
"Dr. Malatesti," he said with sad solemnity.
"Enough!"
interrupted the Paduan, his features cold and passionless, but his voice a furious shriek that froze the friar's veins.
"Enough, I say! The android is without an organism. I knew it from the first. You have disobeyed me."
He strode away with haughty majesty toward the concealed entrance, and Bungie hurried obsequiously to the iron effigy. As the wall yawned asunder, the Paduan turned and bowed low with his extravagant and almost mocking courtesy.
"Pray the black paternoster," said he. "I go."
"Farewell," said Bacon sadly.
"Farewell, sweet Paduan," added Bungie timorously, though in a stentorian voice. "May Saint Francis the Blessed attend you."
"Saint Satan attend ye both," replied the Italian, with another low obeisance.
"Blaspheme not, Dr. Malatesti," cried Bacon sternly.
Malatesti made no answer, but turning toward the entrance, waved his arms. A distant cry was heard, and in a moment Cuthbert was seen darting through the grey gloom of the outer chamber, shivering and gibbering, with the plumed cap and rapier in his hand. Malatesti advanced upon him as he came forward, and the idiot at once receded. Bacon, following, saw him move along the corridor in front of the Italian till the portal was gained and opened, when the latter snatched his cap and sword and vanished into the storm, and Cuthbert, closing and bolting the door, stood still with his back against it. Bacon shuddered, but a great load seemed to lift from his spirit, and a blissful sense of relief succeeded. "Cuthbert," said he after a pause, "come here." The idiot came at once, with his darting zigzag motion, and his face wore its usual stolid and sodden expression. "Cuthbert," said the friar, "stay in the sleeping room and open that portal to no one. Dost understand?"
"Ha!" answered the idiot, in his weak, dissonant voice. "I understand. Shall Cuthbert unbar to Zernebock?"
Bacon understood at once that by the name of the Saxon fiend, the idiot meant to designate the Paduan. "Unbar to no one," he said gently but sternly. He entered the chamber of audience, and taking from the cupboard a large drinking horn, poured into it the remaining contents of the punctured flask, which Bungy had left upon the settle, and returned to the laboratory. The burly friar was standing in the flare of the flambeau, with his massive features pallid and bathed in a cold sweat. "Frere Thomas," said Bacon kindly, "I judge not men by their infirmities. Drink this, it will do you good." Bungy, much agitated, took the wine, and without drinking, gazed fixedly at Bacon.
"Roger," said he tremulously, "I misdoubt me that this Paduan be other than he seems. How knew he of my cousin the vintner, and of my dinner, and of the flask under my frock, and he but newly landed at St. Botolph's Wharf?"
"Tush!" cried Bacon. "Vex not your mind with idle fancies. How know you that he spake truly when he said he was but newly landed? How know you that he pieced not together his knowledge by seeing you at dinner through the vintner's window, and noting, as a conjurer of quick sight may, what was on the table, and further by inquiry as to the vintner's relation to you?"
"That is true, by Dubrick,"
said Bungy, with an air of great wonder, showing immediate tokens of recovery from his affrighted condition.
"It is also true that the day being warm, the window was open, and my cousin's dinner was laid in the room on the ground floor. Moreover, the vintner rose once from table, misdoubting that someone was spying us from one side of the window, though he found no one there."
"Truly, the Paduan might have been there, and withdrawn at the vintner's coming," Bacon went on, half believing that this was the solution of the mystery. "Then, too, he might have noted the shape of the flask through your frock as he sat before you. For the rest, his sorcerer's face and aspect, his wild voice and evil talk, and the gloom of the day oppressed our spirits and compelled them, as it were, to superstitious fancies. I trust he will visit us no more. Much learning, I fear, hath made him mad, and perchance he hath a madman's cunning. Let him pass. I mourn for him. Drink, Thomas, drink. The wine will comfort you." The color had already returned to Bungy's face, and without more ado, he tossed off the liquor, and with a sigh of satisfaction, smacked his lips.
"It is well spoken, Roger," he said sturdily. "By my dame, I have been fooled rarely by this Paduan, and if he comes hither again, I will take the hot tongs of St. Dunstan to him. Certes, he is a godless one, and speaks more like a follower of Mahound than a Christian.
I have oft heard of the impious and unbelieving disposition of these Italian doctors of science, and he is one of them."
A flash of lightning suddenly lit the sky beyond the Louvre, followed by the hoarse roar of thunder. The friars stood mute, with their faces turned toward the android, which, with its rigid lips apart and its staring eyes set upon vacancy, seemed to listen for the long reverberations.
"'Tis a fearful day,"
Bungie muttered, as the silence again descended, broken only by the noise of the rain.
"Eh," responded Bacon, starting from his attentive attitude. "Thomas, I am sorry that Paduan saw the android. It should not have been, but at that moment I could not interpose, and no matter, it is beyond help now. Come, let me show you the passage whereof I spoke."
End of part 4.